Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello. This is David Hanlon, and I appreciate all of you coming, and welcome to our RSVC luncheon. This is our time of the year where we get together twice a year and basically give a report on what we've been doing during the year. And also, we have our special guest today, Jeff Tom, recently retired from the legislative body, and also recently past president of CCB. So he's going to talk to us and give us a report on AB 727. Is everybody here, guys? Okay. All right. Hazel, you want to walk around with the microphone so we'll know who's here?
Okay.
All right. I'm coming. Anyway, I'm David Hanlon, and my wife Gina is here.
That's Roy Harmon. I don't have to tell where I'm from, do I?
No.
No, I'm vice president. So
that's okay, here
you
go.
Deb Meyer.
Sandy Brown, I belong to Andy.
Andy Brown.
No, the RSVC is donating Deb $20 worth of candy.
All right.
Thank you.
Tara Peterson.
Okay, guys, she spoke very softly, and her name is Tara Peterson, and welcome her to the as a BEP vendor. She just graduated.
I'm Joni Apache, and
who?
I'm Joni Apache. What do you mean, who?
The sales lady.
That was Joni Apache. If you didn't hear her,
I'm the better half, Paul Apache.
Yay, Paul!
Okay, here we go.
I'm Paul Apache the second. I'm here just for the lunch.
Paul Apache the second came for lunch. Okay, David.
David Moore, EDD. And
who are you?
Barbara Moore.
Barbara Moore.
Barbara Moore, Cafe 744. Okay. I'm not from here, so it's pretty good. I know some of that.
There. Ron Long, East End Sports Grill in San Diego.
There you go.
Dave O'Farrell.
That was Dave O'Farrell, who isn't presently a vendor, but who used to be a vendor many, many moons ago. So welcome, David.
Suzanne Hood, wife of the vendor.
Here's the president out of our, what is it, the San Joaquin Valley? Yeah, Fresno chapter.
Yeah, Roger Hood, C.H. Warlow.
Yeah. One of those roadside rest guys. Here you go, Gary.
Want to speak?
Gary Machado, Modesto.
That was Gary Machado, Modesto. A lot of our paid guests haven't arrived yet, but I think David and Roy want to go on with the meeting because... Okay.
Okay, anyway, again, welcome all of you here. And recently we have been very busy and actively, despite what some communications have indicated. We are very concerned about AB 727. And Roy will give a little report on that. And that's one of the things that Jeff Tom is going to be talking about. But bottom line, the legislation would require 50% healthy food in vending machines in state building. By the year 2014, and then 100% in 2016. So, we're very concerned about this because this would be very, very devastating for all, especially for all the state vendors. And it could set a precedent for other vendors too. As you well know, a lot of people prefer to have the Snickers candy bar rather than the granola bar or whatever. So they'll just go outside and purchase what they want. So anyway, also we, you know, RSVC has been very, very actively involved in nationally as well as locally. And we've been able to sponsor all the vendors for two years, paying for their dues.
Well, some of them pay.
Yeah, and some of them have paid. So, but yeah, but we are in very dire need of money for our treasury in order for us to pursue and to continue with our trying to represent the vendors and trying to keep an eye on legislation and to be actively involved. CVPC can do what they do, and they are the legal body of our vending program, but RSVC is an organization that enables and helps CVPC in any way that they can. And we are very, very grateful for ACB, for the American Council of the Blind, and the California Council for the Blind, for their, you know, they are very, very helpful to all of us, and especially on the national level of RSVA, and then here in California, RSVC. So, as a matter of fact, a week and a half ago, they were there at the Capitol testifying in front of the committee against AB 727. Frank Welty and Jeff Tom were there. Paul Patchy was there, and Debbie Perk, and just a number of vendors were there, and we really appreciate them being there and testifying on our behalf. But anyway, I just wanted to just point out, if you guys would pay your dues, that would enable our treasury to be built up again. And also, if you could donate, a special gift or a special money, because we really do need to have our treasury built up so that we can do what we need to do. Yeah, and it, of course, it's all tax deductible. So anyway, I want to welcome all of you here again, and let me go ahead and turn this over to Roy Harmon.
Oh, thanks. Thank you, David. I appreciate that. I know I don't want to cut in on Jeff Tom's information, but 727 does affect all facilities on state property, cafeterias, snack bars, et cetera. In fact, we were out last night for dinner, and the menus at the restaurant had a nutritional breakdown of the items they were selling, and this is going to be the law that all our facilities are going to have, according to the FDA, that's going to implement their laws on us, that we have to identify nutritional value, especially in cafeterias and snack bars and vending machines. How they're going to do this? This is going to be difficult, but they do have a plan, and it will be coming forward through RSVC as well as CCB in California, how this is going to occur. There are several issues that have been popping up in addition to the legal 727 issue. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to see the Capital Weekly newspaper this week. There is a nice big front page article on there telling the state it's in to the Supreme Court now. The judgment is going to be coming down soon, and Jerry Brown, is our governor, is going to be supporting this. They're going to be releasing 35,000 level one prisoners, which will essentially shut down approximately six prisons in California. And this is going to have an effect on our prison vendors.
Over two years.
And then they're going to bring them back?
No.
Well, 70% of them.
No.
They'll be here anyway. They'll come back as level two.
Yeah. But, you know, this is, of course, a very serious concern that the legislature is going to be, how they can control our lives very easily. So getting involved is something that you're going to have to do on your own. I mean, we can't do it all for you, and a lot of you do live in Sacramento, and you have a lot easier access to your legislators. An issue that came up on Wednesday, Thursday afternoon at the RSA quarterly meeting held by Dan Pry from the RSA office. He has these meetings. He tries to have them quarterly, but he works around other situations. Like he was going to schedule it last month, but it was scheduled at the same time of the NAMA convention, and he had to postpone it. But a situation had occurred. These are very interesting if you have the opportunity to join in, listen to what's going on nationally. A situation had occurred in Texas where legislation was being pushed through by the legislature there, and hidden in this one bill was the fact that they were going to be selling the state properties to another company, and then, and being a private company owning the buildings, they would not have the priority for the Randolph Shepherd vendor would not exist anymore. And this was, fortunately for the blind vendors in that state, it was defeated. And some of you may know the name Michael Hooks. He's the program manager from Texas. He made a statement on this phone call that said that, you know, if our vendors would get involved, this would have never occurred. It had gotten as far as it did. So that's just a sort of a warning out there. It's going to happen. We have a lot of things going on at the national level that's going to trickle down. I assume Deb can talk more about that that phone call, because she was on there as well. I was sort of in the middle of Capitol Day, and I really couldn't listen to the whole call, so my wife was taking notes, and so I had to tend to business. If none of you know what Capitol Day is, that's when we have the opportunity to go visit our legislatures, senators, assembly people, and talk about the issues at hand. And I've always, whether it was an issue or not with CCB, I've always brought up Randolph Shepherd issues, anything going on to kind of promote Randolph Shepherd. As pointed out in Michael Hook's comments, the legislators know nothing about Randolph Shepherd, and we know that to be very true in California. And it's just an amazing thing that this program has been around for 75 years now, and how many people out there, even the RCBs out there, know very little about our program. That is changing slowly, but it is changing. What else would I have? Oh, anyway, on the DOR News Hour that was held on Tuesday by Director Sauer, he covered several issues, which I'm sure Deb will enlighten us on when she has an opportunity. You weren't there. Thanks a lot. He spoke about them last night at yesterday afternoon at the General Assembly. Usually, you know, generally it was about the procedures that are the way the economy is affecting DOR and what we can anticipate and what we have to do to get out as DOR activists and participate with our legislators, another way of getting involved. He also talked about the VR mod program. I don't know if that's going to have any direct effect on our program. No, it won't. Okay. That takes care of that. But they're modernizing our program, or of the DOR program. So I shouldn't talk too much more. I wanted to turn it over to Deb, because we've got Jeff is supposed to be here at 12, and then Joe is going to stop in approximately 12:15, 12:30. He was scheduled to be here earlier, but he told me yesterday afternoon that he has other luncheons he has to be with as well. So I guess there's a lot of things going on, and it just you just have to follow, keep up with your legislators, find out what they're getting, get involved with your assembly people, get involved with your state senators, let them know who you are, let them know what you do, Have them come out to your location. Let them visit you and see with you in action. This means more to being an advocate than knocking on their door in their offices, you know, because they see you doing something with your life rather than collecting a welfare check. And it's really an important facet of Randolph Shepherd to stand up and be recognized for what you do. And this program has really been up and down in California, and we are starting to build it up again. We have new regulations. We have just about a new program manager. She's learning. She's getting better. it takes time to learn how to deal with all of our little situations. So and she's doing a pretty good job, I think. And we've got more guests coming in. So I will turn the mic over to Deb and let her finish up what I didn't cover.
Hi, Kathy Bales. Thanks for joining. You came to hear me talk?
Kathy Bales and Richard Wayne.
Oh, yeah, Richard. Okay. You missed my speech, Richard. Thanks.
He can repeat it. Put it on rewind.
You know what? Before
give the microphone. Oh, okay. David wants to say something.
Oh,
for
shoot.
For you, David.
Yeah.
He forgot to do that cell phone check.
Yeah.
Richard, could you take 1 minute and please tell everybody here and especially the vendors about the that you would like to have their availability to train new people.
Okay, sure.
Actually, what he wanted was for you to sort of explain what you explained yesterday about the Lighthouse and the career counseling.
Okay, the Blind Leaders Program. So what we've done at the Blind, good afternoon, thank you. What we've done at the Lighthouse is what we started back in 06 at DOR is the BEP, YEP model, where we've taken young adults and now adults who have had a work experience or having their first work experience after onset of vision loss and putting them into a place of employment, preferably with an adult themselves who is blind. So the best model is putting them in a BEP stand where they're working beside an adult who's successfully running their own business, whether it's a small vending roadside rest stop or if it's a large cafeteria at a military base. So we work in San Francisco with Isidro Chavez up on the 10th floor in the federal building, and he makes some of the best Kona coffee, I tell you. And he puts people together, and all the district attorneys come in, and our students are dressed up, and so they're getting a real positive work experience. And so we do that 6 weeks in the summer. We do that year-round. But we're also putting people together in places of employment elsewhere in the community with other people and other sighted folks, just giving them a real work immersion, a real sense of what it means to jump into the workforce and be responsible. So I want to thank you all for supporting that for the past 5 years from the DOR side, now on the nonprofit side, where we've been able to get people and have a real self-awareness of what it takes to work and self-confidence. And it's largely due to the vendors who've helped us kickstart this program statewide. So thank you.
I don't know if you know this, Richard, but the Chicago Lighthouse for the Blind actually created a BEP location in their Chicago Lighthouse for the Blind under Jim Kesselute, and they've created several other locations for BEP in Illinois. So I think you guys have a great group over at Lighthouse, and maybe you guys can come up with some good ideas for BEP vendors all the way around. Yeah, you can, Richard, call Roy and David on that, and they can connect you with Jim Kesselute. I don't know the new director's name at Chicago Lighthouse, but Jim Kesselute was a great guy, and I'm sure he'd be happy to work with you guys.
You know, we did something like that, I'm on the chairperson of the community advisory
committee at the School for the Blind, and we did something similar to that. We showed, we had some of their instructors come up and stay with me for a couple of hours and a couple of different times. And we worked on how to make everything accessible and to sell it. It's like how to label boxes, how to date them, how to put labels on all the shelving, and how to use the ID Mate to find what you're looking for when it comes in. So you can put it in the right places. And then also how to use a talking catch register and a note teller. So now they have a working, it's not exactly a BEP stand because only the teachers and staff things because the kids can't buy candy at school. So the kids can't buy, yeah. But it's kind of like a vending facility. It's a small vending facility and it's and the kids are really learning a lot of social emotional skills. And so that we just, they just won a big award. I guess we just won a big award from the Department of Education for that. So we think that was a cool thing.
Okay. Thank you, Joni. That's good information. Okay, David. It was Deb. That was, Deb was going to talk. Our guest speaker is, he's not late. He's got 5 minutes to get here.
Okay. I only got 5 minutes,
Deb. Thank goodness. So, Richard, I would really like to get together with you and try to work on having that program even bigger throughout the state. If we could, and Kathy and you and I and Richard, I think we need to have a little meeting. Let's make this big, okay? Got a lot of vendors out there that work really hard, and I think that they're very unaware of the program overall. So, is that you, Hazel?
I didn't recognize it.
Attention in the building. Okay, so briefly, what's been going on, of course, BEP continues to have its ups and downs. I continue to make good mistakes, and learn all the time. I think the biggest thing, the big news right now, since Joni mentioned ID Mate, we purchased 109 ID Mates. And they'll be distributed to the locations, and because of their cost, they're actually inventory item. But every vendor who has a primary location except for DOD will receive them. So... They'll be assigned to the location, not the person. All right? So you don't get to take ours with you. And of course, I had to play with it, and I think it's an awesome tool. You can do inventory. You know where everything is. All you have to do is listen. It's got how many actual products does it have in it that's already loaded? It's just incredible. I mean, I had a little vitamin E bottle that, yes, it has all the nutritional content of each package. Okay. One will be used for the students so that they get trained on it. I actually ID Mate sent me one, and they haven't asked for it back. So I'm not going to volunteer to give it back until necessary. So we did that using our funds. So we completed the purchase orders last week. So hopefully your BEC will be bringing you your ID Mates in the next 3 to 4 weeks.
What about training?
We haven't mastered the training. I do know that they have a great tech number that we've been using to try to figure out an inventory issue, and they are very, very helpful, and Joni asks them a lot of questions. It does have a help thing, and it comes with a CD so that you can, a tutorial. I'm gonna attempt to train my BECs, so that they can help too. But with no travel, that I am not authorized to travel. You know, the governor has put a blanket no travel on nothing but mission essential travel. So I'm having I am so grounded. It's kind of killing me right at the moment, because I know I need to go to San Diego. I know I need to go to L.A. The BECs currently are allowed to travel. I have not heard anything or received any direction otherwise, so they are continuing to do their jobs. In the South, it's not so bad because we do have two state cars, so it's not really going to affect them now. We got a state car for LA that they're using, so that's really helpful as far as travel goes. They can go to any location pretty much without it affecting a travel claim. So that's a new change for LA. We never had a state car before. I took, actually Kathy Bales' group was kind enough to donate a state car to us. Of course, I'm paying the bill now. She's not. let's see. What else has been happening? A lot of locations have come up. A lot of people have left locations. We're going to have San Ysidro soon, which is we're calling it San Ysidro Border Port of Entry, something like that, because it really is a route, and it covers a lot of the border patrol, the highway patrol, the port of entry locations, and it's really a huge operation. We're working on figuring out how to do Salinas Soledad State Prisons. We're moving forward as far as we know how much it's going to cost us now. Will we have the resources to actually get it into place, and will we have, what type of funding will we have? As far as the set-aside fund, we are in great shape, and we've spent almost $1 million just in purchases of new equipment for current locations, and we're working on a remodel of one location, and we're going to buy a new trailer for San Diego at 32nd Street, because it's a safety hazard waiting to happen. And unfortunately, the Navy wouldn't give us a location on that base. They said, you use this one or you lose this. So in order to try to keep that location operational, we're going to purchase a new trailer with the setup. So that's huge. We're moving forward as far as purchasing software. The good thing for you guys is the software that we've looked for will have your ability to go online and submit your MORs. We're probably within the next year you'll be able to submit your payment online. Okay. Yes. This will be a fill-in online. Okay. Yes. Yeah, it'll be the same process.
There's one more thing I wanted to talk about briefly, and I don't know a whole lot of the politics behind it, but on the RSA quarterly phone call, the subject came up of our commissioner, Lene Rutledge. Her position, I'm not getting lunch. Our RSA commissioner, Lene Rutledge, her position is one that is appointed by the president. and it has to go through the Senate. She has to be approved by that status. And if you look at the whole scheme of things, she is, that position is half step below a cabinet member. So that's how important of that position is. And that's what we need, is someone with that kind of political power that can help RSA, and especially the Randolph Shepherd program, of which she is a very big supporter of. There is a movement to take away her status of a government, governor's, a presidential appointee. And if this occurs, her position will be nothing more than someone working under the Department of Education. And that will just, you know, limit her ability to work for us. And that will also put the Committee for Purchase, which is 19 presidential employees, appointees, in power. And this is why Randolph Shepherd is trying to work with the Committee for Purchase, as we did in the end of February when I was in Washington. We met with the committee to discuss Randolph Shepherd positions and how we can work together. Committee for Purchase is the organization that has the support of, or supports the NISH program. They have the power to dictate to the Department of Defense contracts of who operates those facilities. So we need to work with them to maintain our status. And so if this situation arises and diminishing of her position, we're going to lose more to the NISH program than we already have. But this is something that's coming up, and you need to all pay attention to this nationally, because it's going to affect, you know, our entire program, state by state by state. Anyway,
and
David.
RSVA does represent the vendors at large nationally. So please remember that, and we need your support.
Yeah, well, thank you, Roy. I want to thank Deb for her report, and yeah, I think we're progressing. And what we're, you know, that's one of the frustrating things with our program, is that, and with all of DOR, that they are so far behind with technology and software, and so we're trying to get caught up. And anyway, before I introduce Jeff Thomas, our guest speaker, Hazel, can you find out who else came in the room?
Yes.
Okay.
Kevin, who was Kevin?
Kevin Berkery, Burbank, California.
That was Kevin Berkery from Burbank, California, and he's the better half of
Artis Bazin from Burbank, California, and I'm the RSVA secretary.
Yes. Yes, and Artis does a lot of work for the vendors nationally, and she used to be a vendor as well. So I think most of you do know Artis, though. And then let's see, Andy, did you get introduced? Yes, okay. Yeah, and I have one over here. Lionel, mm-hmm. You want to say your name?
My name is Lionel Cabral. I'm a vendor in downtown. In Sacramento.
Lionel Cabral, he's a vendor downtown Sacramento. And we have, Steve.
Hello, I'm Steve Fort from this Alameda. I was a vendor up to 2005, and I'm glad to be back here.
Thank you, Steve. Welcome. And we have another guest who came in. Over here, Frank.
Frank Welty from San Leandro, California.
Yes. Frank is, I think, still as of this date, the CCB governmental affairs. What is director of, what's your title? I forgot.
Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs.
Yes, for CCB. And in a couple of weeks, he's joining the San Francisco Lighthouse staff. So we're going to sort of miss some of Frank, but Roy and David will keep him busy anyway. I think that's... wait a minute. I have one more.
I am Tuan. I am Tuan Nguyen, a delegate of the HEB Capital Chapter.
Oh, welcome, Tuan.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you all for being here. And I just love Steve Forth's voice. He's so low. Anyway, what? If you have any articles for the Vendoscope, please get a hold of Hazel.
Our artist.
Anyway, before I introduce, well, I will introduce Jeff Tom right now. In addition to Frank Welty being a representative of our CB legislator, he was in constant communication with Roy and I, and we really appreciate Frank for doing that. But in addition to that, in the background, very heavily so with Jeff Tom, as the president last year and as an interested party. Jeff has always been very, very interested in our program and always inquired about the how it's doing and what he could do to help. So we really do appreciate Jeff Tom's interest in our program. And he just recently retired from Sacramento, from the Capitol, and now he's really retired. But anyway, let me introduce you to Jeff Tom. Please welcome.
Roy has asked me to talk on a couple of items. One sort of general, and to many of you this will be sort of old hat, but to some of you it won't. And that is that he has asked me to let you know essentially what the process is for a bill becoming a law. And the second one is to discuss specifically what we can do with respect to preventing AB 727, that we'll mention in a minute, from becoming law. So, essentially, how does the process start with something? It can start in many different ways. It can start from something as odd as a legislator looking in a newspaper and seeing some crazy thing happening that he didn't like, he or she didn't like, and deciding to come and have staff people draft some concept up as far as changing the law. It can start with a constituent or a group or an interest group like yourself coming and saying, hey, this is what we want to change. It can start with the governor or one of his state agencies coming and saying this, and they do this every year. They draft myriads of, you know, dozens of proposals that they want to change the law. And then they find authors to carry those proposals. There's also, although we won't talk about it in detail, but there's also every year proposals that emanate initially from state agencies that are drafted in order to implement the new budget for each year. And of course, in recent years, those proposals have almost always been in the nature of reducing things because there's no money. So, but bill proposals can emanate from almost anywhere, and certainly they emanate from special interest groups, whether it's the manufacturers or the unions or, you know, nonprofit organizations or you name it, you know, it's a special interest organization or an organization like, you know, RSVC or the California Council of the Blind. And you can go to your legislator, and your legislator has a staff, and that staff will work on the proposal, and they will ultimately send it to the office I used to work for, which is the Office of Legislative Counsel, which is a non-person office that works for every legislator, and they draft the proposal up into its final form. Sometimes they send it back because we don't get it what they want, and they send it back to us a time or two times or three times, but and then it gets introduced as a bill. And so what happens? Well, there's a period of time where that bill has to sort of wait, and after a period of time, that bill will, perhaps with some changes and perhaps without, go to its first committee, what's called a policy committee. The policy committee debates the issue of whether it is a good idea or not. For example, let's say we had a bill that said that all vendors could get free Haagen-Dazs ice cream to sell to at their facilities. And so the first committee would be, and that the state would pay Haagen-Dazs for the ice cream. So the policy committee would debate, well, is this a good idea? And some people would say, well, you know, the Haagen-Dazs isn't such a good ice cream. And other people would say, well, Haagen-Dazs is a great ice cream and we want our vendors to be able to sell it. And, you know, so they would debate the policy issue. And, you know, what you have is a majority of the committee comes from the majority party, which in California is almost always the Democratic Party. And a minority of the party is, you know, and a minority of the committee is from the minority party. And what it takes is a simple majority to pass out of committee. So if there's 9 members, it takes 5, to pass out. So, if it passes out of that committee, and it may get amended while it's there, and it may not, maybe they amend it to say, well, we're only going to limit this to vanilla chocolate and strawberry. We're not going to, you know, the state's not going to, you know, get into the business of providing, you know, apricot, raspberry, or whatever. And so, you know, so the bill gets amended, and it now goes to what is called, and let's say it's an assemblymember's bill, it now goes to what is called a fiscal committee. The fiscal committee looks basically at, first, not all bills go to a fiscal committee. If all a bill did, for example, was to say that, if all a bill did was to say that you couldn't use, that a farmer couldn't use certain substances on his strawberries, and the bill specifically said that no state agency was going to enforce this bill, then there would not be a fiscal cost to the bill, because a bill goes to fiscal committee only if somehow or other there's going to be a cost or a savings to the state. It's a little more complicated than that, believe me. It's you know, crazy attorneys like me that get into lengthy debates with fiscal people about whether a bill has to go to fiscal committee. And of course, you never want your bill to go to fiscal committee if you don't have to, because if you can bypass it, that's just one less hurdle to go through. But sometimes they'll take the state out of the loop in with respect to the bill because it's easier to get through, because you don't have to go through the fiscal committee hurdle. But in this case, let's say, okay, the state is buying the ice cream from Haagen-Dazs, so clearly there's going to be a cost. And besides, the state has to enforce it through rehab, you know, because they work with the vendors. So, you know, there's state costs here, so it's going to fiscal committee. So fiscal committee says, well, you know, this is going to, you know, we don't have a lot of money this year, and this is going to cost a lot of money. So, you know, maybe what we'll do is we will say that we'll leave the bill intact, except we'll say that, yeah, you can buy the Haagen-Dazs ice cream, but we'll do it out of set-aside funds. So we're going to steal the vendor's money to do this instead of the state money. So then, you know, let's say this is sponsored by the vendors, and the author obviously could decide to, you know, drop their bill or not. But let's say they say, well, it's better than nothing. We're getting Haagen-Dazs ice cream and weren't able to get it before or whatever. So, okay, they accept that amendment and the bill passes out of fiscal committee. So now it goes to the floor. And in fiscal committee, you don't ordinarily debate the policy of the bill. Once in a while it pops up anyway. but you don't ordinarily debate it. What can also happen in physical committee is they go on to what is called, and then probably would in a case like this, suspense. Now, suspense, what happens is any bill that costs over a certain amount of money, and nowadays it's very, very little because, you know, they really look closely at anything that's going to cost the state anything at all. They go into a suspense, and basically they have this behind closed doors meeting. It's not a formal meeting of the committee, and they look at what they decide, what bills they decide they're going to let out and what bills they're not. And sometimes it's strictly by party. You know, if the Democrats all want it to go out, it's going to pass, of course, because they are a majority. And sometimes it's everybody. Sometimes all of them want it. And sometimes it's a split. But if they get a majority, they get the bill of committee. And they make those decisions in sort of a closed door way, I guess you'd say. You know, a lot of it is a question of what do we really want to see done this particular year. So let's say they decide we want to get this out. We really want, you know, we want to get the Haagen-Dazs ice cream in these buildings. So we're going to get it out. And so then it goes to the floor of the assembly to be voted on. And if it passes, then it goes over to the Senate. And the same process begins again. You have to go through your Senate Policy Committee and debate whether it's a good or bad bill. You have to go to your Senate Fiscal Committee to debate the whole issue of cost and whether we want to pay for this. And you go back to the Senate floor. Now, if it never gets amended in the Senate at all, it doesn't have to go back to the Assembly. But if they change one word of it, if they do anything at all, even if they change a comma or they do whatever, then it has to go back to the Assembly to be voted on again. Now, if they make changes that are substantive, like let's say they say, you know, we're going to delay the bill for 3 years because we don't think we can afford to do this yet, but we'll do it in 3 years. Or maybe they say, well, instead of doing it now, let's have a study and study whether it's a good idea. So what would happen is if the Senate did that, then it would go back to the Assembly, and an Assembly committee would have a quick hearing on it, because they didn't used to do this years and years ago, but now they have a system whereby when they change it so much that it's really different from when it was before, they will sometimes go back to committee and hear it again quickly, very quickly. That it's not a lengthy process. It's just they may do it the last days of the session or for 5 minutes, unless it's super controversial, and they'll vote up or down. They'll quickly go through their committees and vote it, you know, out, usually out, not always. If it's totally different, sometimes they'll say, you know, we really need this bill, so we're going to take out all the vendor stuff and make it a bill dealing with horse racing, which they can do if they want to do it. And so then they're going to hear it all over again, probably when it goes back to the Assembly. So that's called hijacking a bill. And it happens. It happens. Because sometimes, you know, your bill really isn't as important as you'd like to think it is, or there's other more important things that come up, and your bill sort of gets lost, and then maybe you have to go back next year. So a lot of things can happen, and that's sort of the procedures that is used. There's some entities that are involved in the process that are important to know about, and I'll just take a couple minutes to look at them. Whenever you have a bill that costs money, it's important to be able to have dialogue with the independent legislative analyst's office, because they do independent analyses for the legislature, as well as the Department of Finance, which, of course, is linked closely to the governor, because the Department of Finance does their analyses. And there are times when you may need to talk to them and say, look, this won't cost any general fund money or whatever. Try and persuade them, because if they think it's going to cost anything from the general fund nowadays, they aren't going to, you know, vote for it. There are times when lobbyists are involved. A lot of times, a lot of organizations have lobbyists. And some, you know, can't afford to do it, or they can afford to do it occasionally. We found for ourselves that we're better off doing our own advocating, although, when it's something that's highly controversial and we don't have enough clout, then it can pay to have a lobbyist, because we had a bill that a nonprofit organization for the blind down in LA opposed, and they had a paid lobbyist, and they beat us, because believe me, paid lobbyists can be effective. So that's a little bit about the system. Now, and I guess I have about 10 minutes, and then Joe can take over, and I can eat lunch as well. That's all right, I got some salad. I had some though. Ate half of it. AB 727. So I think everybody in here knows what that bill is. Do I need to go over it again? Okay. Well, I think just to sort of summarize where we're at on that, I think that there are there's a reasonable chance that it can be defeated. It's all going to depend, of course, on the Democrats. The Republicans don't like it for their own reasons, which is good for us, but they are the minority. And the reasons the Republicans don't like it, you know, the whole idea of government getting into your business and things like that, that only cuts a certain amount of, you know, whenever you lobby, you have to identify what ideas sell to the people you're lobbying with. And, you know, when you're trying to sell Republicans, the whole idea of keeping government out of your business is a great thing. And that's, you know, some say that's good, some say that's bad. It doesn't matter. You're going to use whatever idea works. But when you're trying to sell Democrats, you know, that idea doesn't work in the health area. In other areas, it might work. In areas such as, you know, keeping you out of, you know, certain civil rights, you know, certain morals issues, and keeping government out of it would work. But in health, Democrats like bills that help you get healthy. However, there's other arguments you can use. And all parties don't want to hurt small business. And all parties are sensitive to the fact that, you know, if you have a policy and all of a sudden you're dramatically increasing it without any data, you can say, well, you know, is this a good government thing to all of a sudden take this policy to its extreme? We heard many... In the Capitol the other day, there were many instances where aides to Democratic lawmakers were surprised that they were going to essentially take the choice completely out of the hands of everybody and go to this extreme. You know, Democrats like candy bars just like Republicans do. Surprise, surprise. So, you know, yeah, as far as we know. But there are also some other things that I think RSVC and CVPC and others need to explore in terms of looking at alliances, whether it is in this bill or others, but we have something specific to this bill. A former colleague of mine that I worked with for many, many years sort of gave us a hint the other day, kindly. And we don't know that these things will work, but she said, you know, my boss, the speaker, really is into making sure that low-income people have healthy food choices, because they don't. You know, they go to 7-Eleven or they go to the mom-and-pop stores and they have junk. And they don't have the same good choices that, you know, we might at our, you know, nice superstore where we can get all sorts of good fruits and vegetables. And that is a severe problem. There's no question about that. So he and others like him have bills to try and get money to help those chains put in, not chains, those small stores put in, you know, healthy food to do other things to help low-income people. Now, if we align ourselves with some of those efforts that aren't directly, that aren't really directly within the province of the vendors, but that certainly don't harm the vendors in any way, but if we take a look at what we can do to sort of make friends out there in the Democratic fold and say, you know, we want to, you know, it's not really tit for tat necessarily, but in this it is, because if we show them, look, we are sensitive to some of the issues. We're not going to win them all. We're certainly going to win this author over of AB 727, who feels very strongly and justifiably that what she wants is what we need to have, but we may win enough, and we don't need to win all the Democrats over. We in committee, for example, through the good work of a lot of the vendors, Andy and Debbie and Frank Welty, of course, along with, you know, Roy and others, we got one Democratic vote. If we had gotten one more, the bill would have died in committee. So it is really a very fluid thing. And believe me, it doesn't always happen. You know, usually it is a party line vote on these things. And so to have gotten one Democrat was actually a pretty good deal. And remember, it's only passed one committee. It has to get through appropriations, which probably, because since it deals with the state agency, some level or other, it's going to have some physical cost to it, I'm sure. I don't know what they'll say yet. And it's got to get through the other house. There's all sorts of opportunities. The other aspect of that bill is, and this is specific to many of you in this room, your state senator, many of you, is Daryl Steinberg. He is the leader of the Senate. You need, if it gets to the Senate, you need to get letters from every family member and every friend that you can possibly get, because from voters within our district, my district, your district, many of you, to Daryl Steinberg, because remember, he's going to listen to his voters. Now, I think he's termed out after this term, but still, when the district sends him, you know, 200 letters, he's certainly going to think about that. And, you know, we planted the seed the other day when we interviewed with his, not interviewed, but when we had our conference with his aide, that his district was the most impacted in the state. Now, if it gets to the Senate, what I expect from you vendors is to have bunches of emails and letters and phone calls to Daryl Steinberg, the leader of the Senate, because voters do matter. And if you get a couple hundred letters on an issue, that's a lot. That's a real lot. Now, that doesn't mean that he might ignore it and just vote with the rest of his party. He might. But he might all of a sudden say, look, you know, Assemblymember Mitchell, I'm getting a lot of flack from my district. Could we, like, limit this to 50% or something, or do something different? You know, I know you want to get your bill passed, and I want to help you, but maybe we could do something different. Now, I don't know what will happen. I'm just speculating. We don't know. But unless we try, and unless we realize that we have an advantage being here in this district, we don't know the full playing field. So that's sort of what I'm thinking about with respect to these bills. If there's a bill that, and I'll just end with this, you know, it's going to be my privilege to sort of, as a volunteer, take over for Frank in for the remainder of the year. And it's going to be we'll see. It's going to be totally different. I you know, friends of mine that always used to order me around because I was the, you know, they were my client and I was the person who did whatever I was told or got any information. Now I can, tell them this is what I want from you. So it's kind of fun. But to a degree. But you know, feel free, any of you, to call me and to ask any questions you have that may concern regulations or legislation. If it's information I don't know, which it may well be, I'm happy to look it up and try and get you an answer. We are a resource. It doesn't matter whether you're a member of CCB or not. We're a resource for every vendor. We want to be and try to be, because our concern is for blind people, not just CCB members. And I think if there's any, I don't know if I have any time left. I'm not sure because I don't want to take time away from Joe.
Is Joe here? Joe's here?
Yes. Okay. Well, if there's burning questions, you'll have to take a minute, but otherwise I'll let Joe have the... Yeah.
I think you ought to work with Deb to get that ice cream for
us. Yeah. Yeah, I like the ice cream thing. All right, well, thank you very much for your attention, and I'm going to give this mic over, and then I'll eat some lunch.
Thank you very much, Jeff. We really appreciate that, and it really is amazing just how convoluted and complicated that whole process is. It's amazing how any bill gets passed. Anyway, I'd like to now turn this microphone over to Joe Xavier. As many of you know, he's a past vendor, and he has really worked his way up to the level of being the field services what do you call it, the director?
Deputy
director. I couldn't think of that word. So right now I'd like to introduce you to Joe. Thank you, Joe.
Well, good afternoon to all of you. Is Deb here? Did I hear?
Yes.
Okay. So I wasn't sure who was here, who's not. I apologize for being late. I had to speak at the OCB luncheon next door and the guide dog board luncheon, which I didn't make. So I'm making 2 out of 3. Hey, and baseball, that's a great batting average. So just before I speak to you on more specifically, just to pick up on a note of what Jeff was sharing, I'm sure all of you recall Senate Bill 441, Torlakson. So, am I coming through okay on this mic?
Yes, you are.
So, how many vendors can share the impact of 441 in a way that Jeff could use?
Andy Brown kept records.
So, I don't know, maybe Jeff, something to think about? Because the other thing that you might recall about 441, regardless of what happens with 727, there's a sunset date. And what will occur with that sunset date if the impact isn't demonstrated? But share that thought. Okay, let me share a couple things with you about BEP. And then Deb is here and I'm here, so we'll take questions. As long as there's time. Quite some time ago, I sent out to CVPC, NFBC, CCB, RSVC, anybody who was interested, the vision that I thought and Deb and her staff thought would really define the future for BEP. And I'm happy to say that we're still waiting for input. But what's more importantly than that is really I see it becoming a guiding post for the work that is being done. And kudos to the leadership and the vendor community, because I think I hear the discussion saying, what do we want to look like and how do we become the preferred food service of choice? And I think to the extent that we continue that focus, it will do a lot to move us down that road. When people, no matter where they are, when they view us in that light, we're going to be talking about different issues and a lot more positive and pleasant ones at that. One of the things that you may not know, and Deb is here, and I cannot give Deb enough kudos for what she was able to do for BEP. You guys will recall we have the classifications of BEC, Business Enterprise Consultant, and Supervising Business Enterprise Consultant. Deb has managed, working with our personnel shop and budget shops, to change those classifications to associate program government analysts / support or staff services analysts and to manager ones. And that is huge. That is huge for us in the program side, one, to be able to recruit. And these are positions that are open positions, meaning any of you who are sitting here today or your colleagues, anybody you know that meets the minimum qualifications of those positions can go and take the exam now and be eligible when you're done taking that exam to apply for a job tomorrow. Without that, it is very difficult to get into the examination process, and it's very restrictive when Deb is filling positions to recruit people who have that background and those competencies that we're looking for. So those of you, I think, I don't know who else is in here that knows civil service besides Jeff, but he will recognize that is not an easy feat. And I believe it's way, way overdue for this program, and I believe it will set the staffing for this program in a very different path, a very positive one. The RSA 15 report, I know all of you by now have received it. We've shared it in various forums. 112 vendors operating in about 140 locations, some $48 million in sales. Average vendor earnings, over $56,000. That's up from the prior year. That's all good news. Good news is that highest income was reported at some $225,000, a little bit of chump change. The bad news is that the lowest income was reported some $64,000 loss. Median income was $25,000, so half of the vendors make less, half make more. So do we have work to do? Absolutely. Are we glad to see those numbers climb? Yes. And by the way, they're climbing in an environment that has not been friendly to economics and to growth. So all good news. A couple of the other things that I will share with you. Staffing continues to be a challenge because we have a hiring freeze. And in addition to having a hiring freeze, we have travel restrictions. So Deb's staff have been limited to travel for only those purposes and those functions that cannot be performed by phone or email. So, for example, things like location reviews, which you obviously can't do over the phone, some of those functions, travel is allowed, but it has become very restrictive. You guys probably have heard by now that come Monday, the governor is going to release the revised budget. I have told Deb for her not to be surprised if I come to her and say, you're going to have to call up three positions or four positions. Things are not looking good for us right now, folks. These are some very difficult times. We hope that we don't lose any. But history is not on our side when it comes to cuts and it comes to having to achieve the savings that will be forced on us from cuts. There's a lot of demand on the resources. Deb and I had an opportunity to sit down the other day, and she and I were just trying to get our heads around how do we deal with so much of the demand that is being put on us with all of the resources that we have available to us. All the limited resources that we have available. Deb has in the north two vacant BEC positions. In central office, that's in the northern field office. In the central office, she has a vacant assistant program manager, a vacant BEC position that was doing equipment. We have a vacant OT in the south. We have room capacity as a supervisor, but her position is vacant. So this is all, very challenging to continue to meet the demand and the need that we have. So one of the discussions is how do we prioritize with all the resource demands that we have, in supporting the program. I don't know the last time that I was here, we were talking about the Marine Corps. So I'm assuming that by now you guys know that the Marine Corps is the contract was awarded to SSI. I'm sure those of you who are in the room who are involved in that can share some more thoughts on that, which your perspective might be. We also have Fort Irwin. The proposal is in the process of being developed to be submitted here in a short order. So that's another military base, and Ron is sitting here. We're still dealing with the Navy where Ron was, because when the Navy sent out that solicitation, they made it a hub zone solicitation, which precluded the Randolph-Shepard Act from participating in. So we filed a protest that essentially told the Navy, we don't agree with you. We don't think this is mess attendant services, that it's a full food service. And they came back very politely and said, no way. Not only that, you didn't even file a proposal, so you don't have standing. So we continue to work through those issues. Along those lines, let me share with you some other litigations that are in play. We have some six actions that are at hearing and arbitration in federal court status. They include a federal appeals court case, which is essentially determining if the state is going to be liable to a vendor for a loss of income. We have the GSA arbitration regarding the downsize of a vendor's location. We have collection of vending machines, commissions circa the contracting with the post office. We have the Marine Corps arbitration, not specific to the file, to the contract that was submitted, but we are in an arbitration because a vendor believed that they should have been one of the six selected for that Marine Corps, so that's still an active arbitration we're dealing with. We have the United States Post Office arbitration for Long Beach, where the panel awarded judgment against the post office, and to this point we have not resolved that. Navy San Clemente, that's been an ongoing arbitration for quite some time. We submitted a proposal. It wasn't, well, how did the attorneys describe it? We needed to sharpen our pencils to be competitive, and we have not yet done so. Those are some of the highlights. I can talk to you about other things related to DOR, but I don't know if you want to hear about those or if you just you have some questions. Or Deb, if there's any thoughts you'd like to add.
I think that the only thing I have to add is the importance of the lobbying and everything that is required. As Michael Hooks in Texas said, that without you people in the room and doing the things that you need to do to prevent certain actions that legislators might put upon you, that you're the ones that have to be active. He said without that group, that legislation would have gone through. So, again, politics isn't something that's pretty, but sometimes when it's your livelihood, you really need to step up and help out the entire group. So, that's one thing I'm learning. What we've been doing is monthly meeting with, directors from across the states on a telephone conference once a month, and then we're also doing RSA quarterly meetings. I'm doing a Department of General Services quarterly meeting, and we're suspended from doing a General Services Administration quarterly meeting, but that's another story. And as far as moving forward, I think that we're getting on the right track, and you know, you can tell with our finances, which Joe talked about, is definitely in the plus side. And we're all learning and we're all motivated to continue to do better. So any questions for Joe? Because I don't want any. Oh.
Okay. Joe, did you want to make a comment first? Okay. Okay. And then Barbara will come to you.
Okay. So one of the things that I, when Deb and I were sitting down the other day, and so Deb was going through a whole litany of what I have termed as major operational issues that are facing the program, the kind of things that siphon Deb away from having to be able to deal with just some of the proactive things. And that's just unfortunately one of the realities that we have to deal with these days. So she's going to be putting together, you guys have all received in some fashion what I have called the new projects inventory, which is a way of recording and tracking all these many great ideas that we have, but then the question is allocating the resources to plucking them off, and we have completed some of those, and we have staff working on others, so it'll be slow, but we are. But one other area that I think is important is there's an awful lot of operational issues that come that will pull Deb and her staff off of being proactive or working on new locations or working on any host of things that we think are important. For example, a vendor walks away from their location. Okay? That changes staff resources. We have a location where we continue to spend an awful lot of resources to the vendor's been in there for, you know, probably not even a year yet, and we still continue to spend resources to bring that location fully online. We've done one of the prisons. We're working on the second prison. We have a vendor where GSA said, we're moving you from one floor to the other. And the sheer volume of emails alone on what's taking place with that is just resource intensive. So Deb is putting together a list of major operational issues and to be shared with CVPC and to be sent out to all the vendors. Because I think it's important that everybody knows, you know, how are staff spending their time? And these are not your everyday. These are not, you know, Frank had a broken refrigerator and called in for a service call. That's not the kind of issue. It's the kind of issue that, okay, drop what you're doing, new priority type of issues. So, and with that, I'll take questions.
Barbara had a question. I don't know if it was of Deb or Joe.
Well, either one, really. What my question is I'm kind of curious about, Joe, you were talking about the BEC's, you gave them a different title, management or a different title. What are the qualifications for doing something like that?
Okay, so every classification in the state has a what's called a classification description, and it has the MQs on it. The biggest distinction between the BEC classification and the SBEC classification is there's a shift to an analytical basis for the classification. And by the way, just a small little note, staff are very interested in this because it's a significant pay increase. Okay? When I was an SBEC, I left to go become an associate program government analyst, $500 a month more than an SBEC. I supervised nobody. Okay? And I had no contract responsibilities, all of the procurement responsibilities. So, I mean, it's just one of the unfortunate things about when we create these unique classifications because we think that they're so specialized, they really get lost in the negotiations process for salary increases, and they prevent staff from having an upward mobility, and I think that has hurt the program. But I think another piece that's more important here, the fact that you have one of the BECs that I hired, which to me was one of the most qualified BECs, had 16 years of running his own restaurant. You couldn't, food costs, labor costs, what to prepare, how to prepare it, where to buy it, kitchen equipment, he knew it backward and forward. He never heard of BEP. Had no clue it existed. The only reason he applied for the job was because we didn't have a list for BEC, and so we used a comparable list called a staff services analyst position. He was on there, and he saw a restaurant, and he applied. And when we're interviewing him, he had no clue anything about BEP, and we're going, but hell, he's got all the experience that we're looking for. So there's a lot of plus for that. Barbara, what we can do is send you the specifications, but I don't can't cite them to you.
I didn't know this was a question and answer period, but I just, two things while I'm thinking of it, I wanted to mention. For those of us that have rest areas, the status of the Surface Transportation Act is still the same. There has been no change or updates yet, so we're still holding. And the other comment I have is on Tuesday's DOR News Hour, a lot of the talk was about ERA funding, and it didn't seem to be answered to me and at that time. And I was going to ask the question yesterday afternoon, but just it was inappropriate at the time, so I'm taking the advantage now. How are we going to survive without ERA fund? And what is going to happen to our wonderful staff that we have through ERA funding? Where are we going? Perhaps Deb could answer that, or no, come back here.
Oh, well, Joe is raising his hand. Briefly, from a manager's standpoint, I will be crying and taking 6 months off after that. And into heavy therapy, trying to figure out what we're going to do next. But, it's a change. We're trying to prepare. We have some great students who have done an awesome job in filling the gap with all the stuff that's gone on with ARA. And we've got two retired annuitants that are doing ARA and training. And, you know, we've winding down. So, you know, you also have to realize that a lot of our expenditures and workload is going to go away because we don't have that funding, which was unique. So, we are going to try to keep moving forward and do more projects, well, as many projects as we can based on priority.
Yeah, I would definitely echo the whole issue about priority. I mean, and Roy, it's key in BEP because we have a number of positions that have come in that are doing some really good things. We have Dan has come in, is doing a lot of work with the training class, which we think will pay off great dividends for us. Is it Barbara LaShore?
Barbara Brooken
that's come in and that is working on, you know, on the software package and the student assistance and all the work they've been doing. But for the department, it's not just BEP, OCB, Blindfield Services, OIB, I mean, you know, counselor positions across the board. It's, I don't know how else to say this, it's going to hurt like hell. And not only is it going to hurt like hell, I mean, again, we're just telling you about, we're trying to wrap our head around all the prioritizing what we have to do with the resources that we have. Come the end of September, we're taking away resources. Without any action in the budget, we're taking away resources. So whatever the budget brings to us, whether it's, you know, further reductions, further restrictions, we will be losing some 252 positions come the end of September. One of the things that this is more internal, internal operations issue, and frankly, we don't see this having an impact on you, and Deb will bring this to CVPC, but since we're here, we'll share it with you also. We had an organization file a complaint with the Department of Children's Services regarding the procurement practices in BEP. Oh, it has to do it because DGS has the oversight control agency for what we do. And so as a result of that action, we had to sit down and modify some of our internal practices. And so certain procurement functions, we're going to move to centralize where we have one person in the backup conducting those functions because of the heavy it's the right thing to do, frankly. There will be benefits to the program in the long run, but you guys will be hearing about this, and Deb will be sharing that with CVPC, and I'm sure there will be additional discussion. But just so you know, what's the genesis of that change? Any questions?
Okay. I have two questions, one for Deb and one for Joe. So, Deb, because of the situation with the economy and the budget cutback and everything, the San Diego office might be in jeopardy of closing down. And then my second question for you, Joe, is what's the latest status on the executive secretary for CVPC?
So, yes, closing the San Diego office is a possibility. The thing that I did learn, though, is that no matter what, we would have to pay rent at that location until DGS actually fills it. So that's going to be a while. I don't envision that in our future anytime soon based on that information.
And the other thing, let me say that we're closing the office. That doesn't mean that, you know, if we ever get to close that office, we essentially have three staff in that office. It doesn't mean that the staff are leaving San Diego. Okay? So, you know, whether they branch office or district office, does not mean that we're not going to have staff in that area. Your question was about the executive secretary. For those of you who were not at the general session yesterday, we have a hiring freeze. And the only way to fill a position is if we can do internal promotions. Internal, we can move staff from Deb's unit to Kathy's unit, and from Kathy's unit to OCB. You know, we can move staff around. But we cannot hire any positions outside the department unless we have approval from the governor's office. This is a governor that has reduced their staff significantly from a prior administration. The department established some priorities that they needed because we have 1,880 positions. We have to keep 10% of those vacant for salary savings. And we have, on top of that, several hundred vacancies. So, I mean, think about that. You know, the ones just listed in BEP alone, you know, there's, I don't know, four of them there that I can think of off the top of my head. So we sent over, by the way, the executive order established a protocol for exemptions. And if you guys haven't seen that executive order, you should take a look at it. We sent over requests for exemptions. We had three that were approved, and I have been saying prayers and thank you since then. No disrespect to any other program. But the three that were approved was the Orientation Center for the Blind Program Administrator, the Stationary Engineer at OCB, and a huge, huge key in those two positions approved was there a 24/7 operation. Okay? The other positions that we got approval to fill was the Support Services Assistants. They provide reasonable accommodations to individuals with disabilities. Many of them support our staff who are blind and visually impaired, you know, Kathy, myself, and others. We had to get an exemption to fill those positions, and accommodations is a statutory requirement. So think about that in context of filling any other vacancy. Okay? So, no, we have not taken any action in terms of filling the CVPC secretary. And let me tell you what I'm really hoping that doesn't occur next. Is that the next executive order doesn't say, by the way, departments, all temp help, terminate. Temp help is student assistants, retired annuitants, you know, et cetera.
Let's take one more question.
David, I thought you knew that I do volunteer work for CVPC. You always tell me, what are you doing? Anyway, any more questions? Anybody else got a...
No, well, I appreciate, because we talked about the BEP, YEP program at first, and if we had 3 minutes, I wanted to play for you the Rocket Shop Cafe piece that played on NPR last week. I have it queued up. Can I play that right now?
Sure.
Okay.
Mind is more than just a place to snack. It's an award-winning idea. The school's cafe will be recognized later this month by the State Department of Education for its innovative approach to helping youth with disabilities. Rachel Dornhelm paid a visit to the school's campus in Fremont.
It's snack time here at the Rocket Shop. Refrigerator cases are stocked with drinks, and displays hold packaged foods with price tags in large type. Other store items are tagged in Braille.
I would like a bottle of water, Eduardo.
5-0. 1. Anything else, please?
20-year-old student Eduardo Mendez is behind the cash register. Mendez has wavy black hair and dimples when he smiles, which he does often. The shop is equipped with a talking cash register. Its keys are covered in Braille.
Thank you.
Students also have a small scanning machine they can use to verify bills.
Have a good day.
You too, Sam.
Okay.
Mendez says being here is about a lot more than learning to use retail equipment. He says the Rocket Shop has given him a way to meet people that he wouldn't have otherwise.
It kind of comes with the visual impairment, I guess. So sometimes I'll be like, I'm not sure who that person is.
Now, he says, he feels closer to the school community. The California School for the Blind is a public institution that draws kids as 10 to 21 from around the state. About 80 students live on campus. Around 5, get to work at the Rocket Shop.
It's really a real job. You know, it gives you real money, and it feels good to get a paycheck, right?
While Mendez runs the cash register, fellow student Jote Pierwall stocks soda with a handheld scanner.
So I take the soda, put it, and turn it.
Product. Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola.
With her gold bracelets jangling, Pierwall runs her finger along a shelf that's labeled in Braille.
This is Diet Pepsi. And this is the one we need.
Pierwall says she's grateful and never imagined she'd get this learning opportunity in an educational setting. Before coming here, she said her teachers even made it hard to translate things into Braille.
When I was younger, I used to think, okay, is this how it's going to be all through school, where teachers are getting angry? And
the school made this vocational program a food stand for a reason. A federal act from the 1930s, the Randolph-Shepard Act, gives people who are blind preference to run food stands in federal buildings. California has a law that gives priority to blind vendors in state buildings as well. School Superintendent Stuart Wittenstein says students here are training for very real jobs once they graduate.
Some of our youngsters have multiple disabilities, and they may not be able to own their own business, but they could work for somebody who does if they get those skills here. And some of our students may very well become Blind Enterprises vendors.
A parent at the school is such a vendor and helped launch the Rocket Shop with equipment and management advice. Joni Patchy runs a concession stand called Joni's at the Employment Development Department in the state capitol. Between serving customers and with her guide dog curled behind her, she says she noticed when she has blind student interns during the summer, they needed to improve certain skills.
Counting change, figure it out. You have to straighten things up every day when you come in because sometimes the candy bars get crooked. Things that you don't notice if you don't look for them. And also concentrating on looking at people when you talk to them. Even if you can't see them, you have to face them so that that's part of communication.
Patchy says she's a huge fan of the project and would have been grateful herself for a program like it. Back at the Rocket Shop, teacher Alyssa Chatto agrees. She's come in for a cup of coffee with her guide dog, Ellen.
Good girl. Good dog. Good girl.
Hey, how you doing?
Chatto says when she was the student's age, she didn't have a lot of confidence in herself.
And that's why I particularly want to see these kids succeed. I really want them to get out there and show what they're made of.
Eduardo Mendez and Joe Pierwalt will do just that in Sacramento this month. They'll help accept the Excellence Award the state is giving to the Rocket Shop on May 27th. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
Thank you, Richard. That was really, really great. Okay, I'm bringing the mic back to David, who's going to call the meeting closed, I think.
Okay, thank you very much. Listen, first of all, I have a lot of people to thank. Thank you, first of all, Joni, for all the snack food that we have here. And I also want to thank Jeff Tom for his wonderful presentation of legislative reality here. And thank you very much, Jeff. And then Joe Xavier and Deb Meyer. So I want to thank all of you for being here today and hope to see you this fall, I believe, in L.A. So thank you very much. Yeah, right. We have by the way, we are having a RSVA convention in Reno, Nevada, in Sparks. So that's, July 9th?
July 9th
through 12th. July 9th through 12th. So we'll be sending you a newsletter with more information. Thank you all for coming.